Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
I've always had this, like a lot of guys, a lot of fascination with drug culture. Drug dealers, how they're manufactured, doing them, you know, all the above.
The hierarchy.
And, you know, there's a lot of interesting stuff, and there's a lot of dark things. David Holdhouse is an investigative journalist, Rolling Stone, Village Voice. He, at 93, and I think I have it right, we're going to talk to him real shortly. He was in the Emerald Triangle, I think it's the Humboldt County, where a lot of the illegal weed comes from. And it's, you know, listen, it's a lot of money, it's high risk, it's one thing, you know, there are people in jail at the time for having weed. Let alone manufacturing, distributing, selling weed. That's, you know, you're hitting the triple felony. So it's a very serious business. A lot of the hippies would think they could go there. They could be trimmers. They could be part of it. There's just weed, man. It's just weed, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what they found out very quickly is, you know, you don't F with the money. So if you go sideways, I mean, they're not going to let you walk away from that.
Not that life, no.
No. And not when you could say something to somebody. You could bring them down. Maybe they're, you know, you get pretty weird up in the hills year after year doing something illegal.
Our next guest is a writer, producer, and director, a former investigative journalist who has gone undercover with Nazi skinheads, and a documentarian who has helped cover subjects from Lorena Bobbitt to serial killer Richard Ramirez. And now he tells the tale of drugs, murder, and a massive mythical monster in the three-part Hulu series, Sasquatch. Please welcome David Holdhouse.
Hey, David, welcome to the show.
Hey, man, thanks for having me on.
So, we were just talking about the Emerald Triangle. I'm correct, up near the Redwoods, isn't that the Humboldt County area?
Yeah, it's Humboldt County and, like, northern Mendocino County and Trinity County. So that's why it's called the Emerald Triangle. But, yeah, mostly Humboldt.
And since I was a kid, you know, the stories were always from Humboldt. And I've ridden my motorcycle a few times through, you know, from Portland down to San Francisco. So I've been all through that area. And it's funny because now you see all these young, quasi-hippie, dreadlocked, super tie-dye, they think there's an idealism that comes along with weed sometimes, a cultural idealism, that they think it's going to be this real peaceful, kind of cool, like everything's going to be great. And even though it's legal now, it's still a pretty dark industry in a lot of ways.
Well, there's just so much money involved.
Right.
I mean, like the origin of the dope growers in the Emerald Triangle was sort of back to the land hippies moving up there in the late 60s, early 70s. And that scene still exists, but it's not the dominant weed-growing scene up there. So the dominant weed-growing scene up there is a much darker world. You know, I mean, it really, like, in the late 70s, two things happened. One, the price of weed started to spike to the point where, like, by the late 80s, they were getting $5,000 a pound on the East Coast for Emerald Triangle bud. The other thing that happened is that cocaine started to become popular, and they started to do what they call green for white, which is like they started to trade weed for coke or coke for weed the other way. And, you know, once you started introducing that drug into the sort of ecosystem up there, it changed the nature of things.
Sure.
You know, it's what the old timers up there will tell you. So, yeah, it's like the stereotype of weed is like a peaceful drug. You know, the effects, sure, but like the industry that creates it is just as violent of a drug subculture and narcotics trafficking scene as, you know, meth or heroin or coke in a lot of instances.
Sure. 93, you're up there, and you hear a bit of a story, but the way they were telling it, it was a Sasquatch, a Bigfoot, a Yeti, whatever you want to call it, a skunk ape, killed and tore people to pieces. And it, of course, you know, anybody with half of a curious mind would be like, really? So a Bigfoot killed him, huh? But that's bothered you all this time.
It did. I mean, that story stuck with me. Yeah, these two guys showed up at this cabin where I was staying on a weed farm near a town called Branscombe in Mendocino County, claiming that they were clearly traumatized and freaked out. And that's what always really stuck with me, is that they seemed credible when they said that they'd just seen three bodies that were, like, mutilated, you know, partially dismembered bodies on a nearby weed farm a little bit further back up in the hills, where they'd gone to, like, help trim some buds because it was harvest season, which is a really dangerous time up there. And then they found instead these three guys they were planning to meet and work with were, like, dead and torn up, and they said that they saw Sasquatch footprints and in the mud because it was raining like hell that night. And they said that they knew it wasn't a ripoff because all the bud was still on the plants. Some of the plants were torn down, sort of thrown around as if something had ripped them out of the ground. But the bud was still there. So, like, you know, $100,000 in weed, at least, was still just hanging off the branches. So, of course, that story always stuck with me. At the time that I heard it, I really didn't have, like, the skill set to go try and find what truth was behind that, if any. So, you know, a quarter century or so later, when the opportunity came up to actually try and track that legend or whatever it is, which is sort of the heart of the series, like back to its source, like I jumped on it.
Well, clearly, as you get in there, there's going to be names attached to those bodies. So now they know who the people were, correct?
No, they don't.
Really?
And actually, the homicide could find no record that I could, like, the Emerald Triangle has the highest per capita rate of missing persons. People just vanish off the face of the earth by far in the United States. And so, but I looked at all the missing persons reports. I couldn't even find a missing persons report that matched up. So to this day, I'm not entirely sure that three guys actually were killed. I think so. You know, I think it's far more likely than not. But it was more, the series is really about finding out why that story, which is obviously a fantastic story,
sure,
fantastic in a sense, it's very difficult to believe, why that story was making the rounds.
But this was a firsthand account that these guys were laying on you. This wasn't, I heard this. This was guys who walk in and they're saying they just saw it that moments prior to coming into your area.
Yes. Immediately they came directly from the murder scene to the cabin where I was. And again, I want to reiterate, they seemed terrified. Okay. There's no way that they were faking it. I'm convinced to this day.
Oh, well, let me go backwards then. Let me go backwards to 93. At that moment, what do they do and what do you do? Do you say, we should call the cops? I mean, obviously, you're at a weed farm. I guess you can't call the cops.
Hell no, man. I stayed silent. I was just there as, like, sort of a guest trimmigrant, right? Which is a trimmigrant is somebody that goes up there and just does seasonal work, trimming, packaging buds. I had a buddy that had been working up there for, like, more than a year, and he sort of got me a guest pass onto this farm. And I'd already been warned, like, by the owner of the farm, like, you know, you don't ever leave the farm unless you're going home. There's no going back and forth to town. Like, you go sideways on this at all, like, you're getting buried on this farm. So don't F around.
Yeah.
And so I was already pretty sketched out. And so when these guys came with this story, I was just trying to sink into the couch that I was sitting in. I didn't say a word, bro. I was trying to pretend like I was not there.
Sure. No. You don't want to be a witness to anything. Sure. Because then you have people start talking, and then all of a sudden, well, how many people know this? And then you get part of the cleanup.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, I was 22 years old at the time, too. So, I mean, I was like, I was a kid. And I was just, frankly, I was just terrified. I was scared as they were.
So now you go back, and you can't find a record of the three. Do you believe that you found the area? Do you think that you could track its way back based on what those guys told you?
Yeah, I think it was in an area known as Spy Rock Road, and specifically an area of Spy Rock Road, Iron Peak. And Spy Rock Road is a particularly notorious weed-growing region in northern Mendocino County. There's, just, like, a lot of violence there. There's a lot of, a lot of people that disappear. There's a lot of murders that are documented and a lot of rumors of murders that have never been reported. And it's, frankly, I talked to the cops there, and they're like, you know, frankly, we don't go there unless we go in force. So if you're, like, a homicide detective in Mendocino County, you don't just, like, go up Spy Rock by yourself to ask questions. The only way the cops go up Spy Rock Road is if they're rolling pretty deep, okay?
I'm sorry to interrupt, but you get up here, and what do you believe? I mean, look, the Sasquatch thing, that's hard to take in. It's the most obvious would be, hey, man, they got sideways with somebody, stole something. You know, maybe they just got murdered, and then the guy was going to come back and dispose of the bodies, and in the meantime, these guys wandered upon him. But in the end, if it's true, I can't buy that it's a Sasquatch. What do you think?
No, I don't buy that it was a Sasquatch. No, definitely not. I think it's possible, and here I can't give away any spoilers, right?
Right.
But I can say this much. I think it's possible that somebody or several people staged that murder scene to deliberately make it seem as if a Sasquatch had killed these guys. And there's a long tradition up there of growers using the legend of Sasquatch to keep people in line, specifically like trimmigrants that come from South America and Europe that maybe don't know better. They've just vaguely heard of Sasquatch. Like, growers would tell them, there's an angry tribe of Sasquatch around here, and a lot of growers have these stilts that they use to make fake Sasquatch footprints. And so they'll stamp them, like, in a perimeter around their farm. They'll be like, you don't go to town because there's angry Sasquatch in the woods. And the only way you go to town is if I drive you in my truck. Because they don't want trimmigrants, traffic back and forth from their farm.
There's a long
tradition up there of using fake Sasquatch staging, if you will, to scare people. So it sounds like a crazy story, but it's actually like, and then once you introduce crystal meth in the equation,
yeah,
there's a river of meth that runs through this story. There's a certain logic there.
Well, listen, it's the drug culture and especially trimmigrants and the people that come through, because, you know, you get down, you start talking chupacabras and especially if it's uneducated people, they're always steeped in folklore. So they're easy to kind of bring into your new scam, your new truth that you're trying to lay on them, right?
Exactly. That's exactly what I think. I mean, the series invites you to draw your own conclusions, okay? There's no way to neatly tie up a story that involves three guys being murdered by a Sasquatch on a weed farm. But, you know, I personally think that someone was trying to, like, capitalize on folklore and superstitious beliefs to terrorize a certain subset of criminals up there at that time.
Yeah, you got a great sense of adventure and wanting to do a little journalism, man. You got a touch of the Thompson, don't you?
Oh, yeah, man. I set about trying to become the second incarnation of Hunter S. Thompson. I don't know how close I came, but I'll tell you, I had a good run there in the 90s especially, where I don't think anybody else came closer.
I loved him. I mean, I loved everything he ever did, everything. So I'm a fan of the gonzo journalism. And to the point where, like, you know, you think about you, and after I dug in a little bit, I didn't realize that you went undercover the Nazis, the neo-Nazi guys.
Yeah, I worked undercover in the neo-Nazi movement off and on for about 5 years. I did one story in Denver in 2002, thinking it was going to be a one-off. But as soon as I got on the other side of that curtain and saw, like, how sort of big and well-organized and well-financed, like, neo-Nazi subculture is in the U.S. and the ties between the culture here and in Europe, I became, like, fascinated with it. And also found out that for whatever reason, I was pretty damn good at posing as a neo-Nazi, and so it became my thing for about 4 years in the middle 2000s.
Do you tell me this, because this is what I always wonder. We see, like, the what's the Johnny Depp undercover movie?
Johnny Brasco.
You know you're surrounded by bad guys, but even then, if you spend enough time, do you make a friend where you look through a guy's crap politics and his terrible heart, but there's something else about him? You go, but I did kind of like that guy.
You know, that's such a great question, man, because that is so true. I find that to be so true, and especially in the neo-Nazi movement. And part of why I started focusing on the neo-Nazi movement is like, oh, man, I need the bad guys that I'm tricking and busting, basically,
yes,
my articles, to be indisputably bad guys. Like,
sure,
there's so many shades of gray in other criminal underworlds, and I was finding I was liking the criminals a lot, that I thought, oh, I move into the neo-Nazi world, I'm not going to like any of these guys. And that wasn't the case. That wasn't the case. There's, like, a lot of kids that get drawn into the skinhead scene that are just sort of like, they took a wrong turn at the Renaissance Fair, you know?
Yeah.
They're just, like, looking for some sort of scene to belong in. And, yeah, I did wind up. I mean, listen, there's some horrible people, obviously, especially the leaders of the groups, but the, like, rank-and-file recruits, like, a lot of these were just, like, lost-soul kids that actually had good hearts, believe it or not.
Yeah, well, no, that's part of it. Because, listen, I grew up, there was an infamous punk rock club here in Kansas, Lawrence of all places, called The Outhouse. There's a great documentary on it. It was just literally a tractor building in the middle of a field, and we all went to hardcore shows there. And then once the scene started developing into everything it did in the 90s, you could see how normal kind of meatheady, but they liked punk rock, but they weren't super weird, but they gravitated towards that whole scene. And yeah, man, I watched a whole division start in that scene.
Yep.
It's, man, and not to mention the fact that those guys are not kidding about infiltrators and getting given up, and they will make a guy disappear. Like, you ran a very real risk of getting aced yourself.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. I mean, like I said, I have an ability to kind of disassociate when I'm in like really sketchy situations. I mean, I can kind of like separate myself from what quote unquote normal people would feel as being like a really terrifying situation, I guess. And I trace that back to some like childhood trauma that I had, like when I disassociated. So it's like focused correctly. It can be, it's a very useful skill. I mean, that's just a fancy way of saying that, like, for whatever reason, I can sort of stay cool. Like, I don't present as being, like, I present as if I belong. I present as if, like, you know, that the things going on around me are perfectly cool with me. Gosh. And for that reason, like, I'm accepted, whether by criminals, I've found, all throughout my career, whether I'm posing as one of them or whether I'm just embedding with them, meaning, like, they know I'm a reporter, but they're letting me into their world. Like, for whatever reason, like, it just works.
If you're just joining the show, David Holdhouse, investigative journalist, years, Rolling Stone, Village Voice, Hulu has a three-part documentary series called Sasquatch, streaming now, three people killed at the pot farm near the Redwoods, and that led us into a discussion about him when he went undercover with the Nazis and died. It's sad. Well, look, we got to stay in touch, David. Whatever you got going, whatever you've got doing. Plus, I'm going to look back through a bunch of your writing, just because, again, I'm a huge Hunter Thompson fan, which, side note, did you know his widow is opening up Hunter's writing cabin at Owl Farm, and you can stay there now.
Man, I didn't know that. You just made my day. Thank you.
Yeah, no, I plan on, next time I'm in the area, I'm going to try to get a night there. And it's just, she seems to be a very, very sweet, I guess all his peacocks are still there, and you can still look out, and you can still see all you know, Hunter around.
Yeah, amazing.
Yeah, that sounds great. All right, brother, listen, man, nice to meet you, David.
Yes, likewise. Thanks for having me on.
All right, brother, see you there. So for those of you who don't know, Hunter wrote like Fear and Loathing, Las Vegas, a Johnny Depp movie.
Mm-hmm.
But he wrote the book, but he wrote a lot of books.
Mm-hmm.
Fear and Loathing, Campaign Trail, and The Curse of Llanos, and The Rum Diaries, I devoured these things. I just, as soon as I read his weirdo, super psychotic, drug-fueled nightmare writing style, mm-hmm. like I read Fear and Loathing 15 years before the movie got made. He was such a bizarre personality, you know, when he offed himself.
Mm-hmm.
He told everybody he was going. He goes, yeah, when this is no longer fun, I'm going to go ahead and check myself out. And it was sad, but we all knew he was very public for a long time about it. And Johnny Depp spent $2 million building him a statue of his power fist. So when he ran for sheriff in Aspen back in the 70s, his symbol was a fist with a peyote button in the middle. And it was Thompson for sheriff. And he didn't win, but he almost did. And it was just all this audacious, over-the-top insanity all the time with this guy. He loved guns, he was a great writer, and he did drugs, and he was unashamed about it. And he loved sports and politics, and he rode presidential candidates' airplanes with him on their campaign trail. Mm-hmm. And you know, and then if you saw the movie, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, are you kidding?
Mm-mm.
You should watch this.
Okay, I'll put that on the list.
I'm telling you, nobody I've ever met has ever watched it and said, that wasn't fun. It's maniacal because it's a true story, embellished with gonzo journalism. But to the point, the statue they made was, I think they said he may have spent I don't know how many millions of dollars Johnny Depp did of his own money to make it. And they shot fireworks. And when they did his memorial, the Hunter S. Thompson memorial is unbelievable. Hold on, let me tell you this. I'll have to show you a picture of this.
I do like when they listed all the random things that Johnny Depp's blown his money on. I think that was one that was noted.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's the crane putting it up. See mm-hmm. how big the monument was?
Mm-hmm.
Hunter himself designed that and said, this is what I want when I'm dead. He'd go off his back porch, he had a cannon he'd shoot, and then they spent who knows how many millions of dollars for the fireworks show that happened that day. And he just had a profound effect on a lot of people, man. I bought a replica poster from the sheriff's candidacy race, signed by his widow, which is very nice and numbered because that's how much I loved it.
That's awesome.
Yeah, no, I'm always looking for Hunter S. Thompson stuff. I have some Hunter S. Thompson blotter that it does not have LSD on it, but it's got the Ralph Steadman, the artist that always illustrated his stuff. I know, I'm getting super
nerd.
Fear and Loathing.
You will notice that I have distinguished four distinct states of being in the cannabis or marijuana society. They are cool, groovy, hip, and square. If he figures out what is happening, then he can rise one notch and become hip. And then if he can convince himself to approve of what is happening, then he becomes groovy. Groovy.